from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Will the politics of guns in America change after Newtown? Will the policy? That was the question on the table yesterday as President Obama laid out his push for change, some by executive order, more by appeal to Congress for legislation. Will it act, and how? This hour on Point, American gun politics and policy now. You can join the conversation. Are 20 dead children in one attack enough to change our national policy, our national politics on guns? And what do you make of the president's proposal? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was the president yesterday at the White House, surrounded by children who wrote him letters seeking curbs on guns. He unveiled 23 executive orders and his proposal to pass broad gun control legislation.
In the days ahead, I intend to use whatever weight this office holds to make them a reality. Because while there is no law or set of laws that can prevent every senseless act of violence completely, no piece of legislation that will prevent every tragedy, every act of evil, if there is even one thing we can do to reduce this violence, if there's even one life that can be saved, then we've got an obligation to try.
Will it be easy? No, said the vice president yesterday before the president's announcement on gun control. But, said Joe Biden, it's necessary.
I have no illusions about what we're up against or how hard the task is in front of us. But I also have never seen the nation's conscience so shaken by what happened at Sandy Hook. The world has changed, and it's demanding action.
So what about what's been proposed and what comes next? With us first today from Washington with a read on the politics awaiting the president's proposal on Capitol Hill is Charles Babington, congressional correspondent for the Associated Press. Chuck, Charles Babington, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And to begin to look at the policy proposals with us, Robert Spitzer is here, professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland, leading expert on gun laws, the Second Amendment, the NRA, author of The Politics of Gun Control, The Right to Bear Arms, and more, a member of the NRA and of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Robert Spitzer, welcome back to you as well.
Hello, Tom. It's good to be with you.
We'll look at the politics in just a second here, but Robert Spitzer, what about the policy that the president laid out yesterday? You got 23 executive orders or formal instructions here, and then a raft of legislative proposals. You've looked at gun control for a long time. Does this look like an effective plan to your eye?
It's quite a comprehensive plan. It covers a lot of ground, both, as you say, is 23 executive orders and proposals to Congress. We haven't seen the actual legislation that's going to go over to Capitol Hill, although I'm sure it'll be ready soon. It's an ambitious set of proposals. It's really designed to a great degree to plug a lot of leaks. Of course, the lead proposal that's gotten the most attention is to reinstitute the assault weapons ban, which was in effect for 10 years from 1994 to 2004. And that will probably be the most difficult one to get through Congress if he's able to do it. But in addition, the effort to put a limit on high-capacity bullet magazines, also a significant proposal, I think, and to close various loopholes and problems with the background check system. All of that taken together, pretty ambitious. It's pretty wide-ranging, and I think he wants to get the attention of Congress and congressional action quite soon on these matters.
Those three big elements would need Congress to sign off. The executive orders do not. They're described as fairly modest. What's important in those 23?
Well, again, there's a lot in the executive orders, and a lot of it looks pretty mundane because a lot of it is about information and data and record keeping, but it really gets to a very important point about that whole matter. One of the important things you do when you make public policy is study the policy issue. What's the data? What's the information about habits and patterns and so on? And there's been a pretty systematic effort over the years, frankly, by the gun lobby to hobble that effort and keep the government and the rest of us fairly in the dark about actual gun patterns, gun trafficking, gun uses, gun habits. And much of this effort is to try and sort of unblock that by reinstituting better access to gun data, by gathering that data more systematically. For example, to take one instance, the states are supposed to provide information not only about people who are felons, convicted felons who are not mm-hmm. allowed to have guns, but also who have problems with mental health issues. And even today, 30 states provide no non-criminal background check data to the federal data system. And that is an obvious problem, an obvious gap that needs to be filled. And the Obama administration is trying to address that, and a lot of other research efforts and data gathering and analysis as well.
Research that the CDC, under gun lobby pressure, has been cut off from even doing about gun violence for 15 years or so now. Charles Babington began to look at the politics of this with us. You know, at first blush, it can look like there's just no way. Harry Reid, Democrat in the Senate, people are reading him and saying he may not even bring it up. And John Boehner says he won't act unless the Senate brings it up first. On the other hand, there's Newtown and a sense of something changing in the American attitude on guns and gun safety. How do you read the politics, Chuck?
Well, the question is, how much did Newtown change and how long can that change endure once you get into a full-blown political debate in Congress with the various lobbies, including the NRA. I noticed that the phrase uphill battle was used in the headline or the lead today on these stories in the New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, Wall Street Journal, I'm sure other papers. And I think that's probably right. Particularly the assault weapons ban is definitely going to be a heavy lift in Congress. I would say the odds are against it. It's possible that some of these other things might get through. Probably the universal background check would have the best chance, I would think.
And does that mean a little bit may happen here? A lot may happen here? Are you saying there's Republican readiness that Harry Reid too could come in on the background checks and maybe lickety split and done?
I don't think, no, not lickety-split. This is Congress, after all. Mm-hmm. Nothing happens lickety-split. And I don't know. Even the universal background check may run into problems. But it does seem you've heard the least initial opposition to that, I would say, from Republicans and others. Since we already have, background checks on and have had for a number of years when you purchase a gun from a licensed dealer, you know, that much has already been done. So the question is, do you just go ahead and apply it to private sales? But at the same time, you know, the country has moved to the right, and Congress has moved to the right on this issue. If you pull the camera back in 1969, a presidential commission recommended banning handguns. Can you imagine even mentioning that today? It just shows that how much the debate has moved further, so that we're talking about much more modest things than we were talking about in the 60s.
Robert Spitzer, the country certainly moved to the right on guns. But we've had a series of mass killings in recent years, and a lot of people after Newtown said, wait a minute, we've got to reconsider. By no means everybody, by no means, but where do you see the national political chemistry on this now, Bob? Has the NRA still got a lock on this?
Well, the NRA certainly has a great deal of influence, but one of the things we would observe historically is that there's an inverse relationship between the influence of the NRA and the extent to which the issue is being publicized. And at moments in time, such as the current one, where the public is really, kind of aroused and angered and dismayed about, this terrible shooting last month and the consequences of it, that's a time when the political atmospherics are ripe for change, if government leaders are able to make that happen. That's been the pattern in past times when changes have occurred. I would note in terms of public attitude and public mood, polling on gun control, it goes back to the late 1930s when modern public opinion polling really began. It was one of the very first issues that was asked in polls. And from the late 1930s to the present, we can say with a fair degree of confidence and consistency that most Americans have supported stronger gun laws than what we've had on the books. It's really a quite consistent trend. Now, having said that, in about the last decade or so, really during the Bush era, Bush presidential era, public support for gun control declined noticeably. And I think two key reasons for that. One, because the Democrats at the national level, by and large, avoided the gun issue because they thought it hurt them at the polls in previous elections, although studies have demonstrated that's not the case. And because you had in the White House a president who was very friendly with the gun rights community and who advanced their agenda. So when the government, you know, takes a position on an issue, that can have a certain effect on public opinion. And I think it was a key reason why the public began to turn against or was less supportive of stronger gun laws. But we've definitely seen a change in recent weeks. There's no question about that.
Events can have an impact as well. And, of course, last month in Newtown, Connecticut, that 20 young, 5- and 6-year-olds killed there, plus half a dozen adults, teachers, and more, just shocked the country. Here's indie songwriter, singer Ingrid Michaelson and children from Sandy Hook Elementary performing Somewhere Over the Rainbow behind us. Maybe that's where gun changes lie. Chuck Babington, Bob Spitzer, please stand by. We're talking about gun policy and politics today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about gun policy and politics and the president's big push for change after Newtown. Charles Babington is with us, covers the Congress for the Associated Press, joins us with us today from is with us from Washington. Robert Spitzer is here from the State University of New York at Cortland, big expert on the Second Amendment, gun law, gun control, and much more. We'll hear from advocates on both sides of the gun safety, gun control issue in just a moment, but here's the president yesterday listing universal background checks as one of his top proposals for Congress.
If you want to buy a gun, whether it's from a licensed dealer or a private seller, you should at least have to show you are not a felon or somebody legally prohibited from buying one. This is common sense. And an overwhelming majority of Americans agree with us on the need for universal background checks, including more than 70% of the National Rifle Association's members, according to one survey. So there's no reason we can't do this.
Universal background checks, the call there, plus an assault weapons ban, plus a cap on the number of bullets that can go in a magazine, 10 in a clip, the president would have, and a whole lot of executive orders as well. The background to all this, of course, the terrible killing in Newtown. There were children right on the stage yesterday with the president, some very moved by that. Some said it was the wrong place for them to be. Here was Senator Marco Rubio, Republican from Florida, talking on Laura Ingraham's radio show on Wednesday, saying the president's proposals just aren't going to work.
I would just say that to suggest that those of us who do not agree with his public policy prescriptions, to suggest that we don't equally care about children, I think that's where, you know, I start to get bothered by it. We're all equally outraged by it. But what he's proposing and what he's going to propose, it's not going to work. It would not have prevented Sandy Hook, and it won't prevent them in the future.
Senator Marco Rubio saying this isn't the way to go. The NRA saying no thanks to most of this and coming out this week with a video very tough on the president, shows a school lunchbox with the presidential seal on the side and then goes after the president saying his daughters are protected by security when they go to school. What about the rest of the country? Here's some of the sound from the NRA video.
Why is he skeptical about putting armed security in our schools when his kids are protected by armed guards at their school? Mr. Obama demands the wealthy pay their fair share of taxes, but he's just another elitist hypocrite when it comes to a fair share of security, protection for their kids, and gun-free zones for ours.
I mean, you look at that, you listen to that, and you think, what exactly are they thinking? Rush Limbaugh yesterday just mocked the kids who appeared with the president as he announced his gun safety measures on his radio show.
The children are writing letters to the president. Please, we don't want to die. We don't want to die.
Rush Limbaugh's take, well, no, they don't want to die. Chuck Babington with us, Robert Spitzer with us. Let's bring in a couple of more voices right here. Richard Feldman joins us from Las Vegas, Nevada. He's president of the Independent Firearm Owners Association. He's out in Las Vegas right now at the Shooting, Hunting, and Outdoor Trade or SHOT Show. A lot of guns right there. Author of Ricochet, Confessions of a Gun Lobbyist. Richard Feldman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Josh Horowitz joins us from Washington. He's executive director for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He was at the president's announcement yesterday at the White House. Josh, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think of what the president laid out? Does it look like an effective program? You heard Marco Rubio says no.
Well, I think what the Newtown shooting has done is open a conversation about gun violence in America. So some of the things that we saw yesterday are not only directed at trying to stop a mass shooting. What they're trying to do is stop the shooting that we have every day in America that includes some of those mass shootings. And so when you talk about the number one priority background checks for all gun sales, you understand that that's one of the main trafficking channels we see in America is guns going from the regulated to the unregulated market. And that would put a stop to those types of transactions and make the people who transfer the guns responsible. And so we think that we're very pleased with it. We also thought that his tone was really pitch perfect. He talked about the fact that people who live in America, it's not only Second Amendment rights. We have our rights to live in peace and happiness and security. And I thought that frame was really pitch perfect and resonated with a lot of Americans.
Richard Feldman, how did you hear the president's announcement yesterday, his proposals yesterday? Does it look reasonable? Does it look like an effective package to you?
Well, when we talk about the executive orders, I was at the White House last week in the meeting with the vice president, and we were very pleased to see that we really did have a conversation. He took us up on a lot of our suggestions that are in there. Some are more general, some are more specific. We certainly do have, and will on Capitol Hill oppose some of the things, but as Josh knows very well, we've always supported mandatory background checks at gun shows because you're in the same position at a gun show that a licensed dealer is in. You're open to the public. But the bigger problem is really the 500,000 guns stolen every year in America, and we're not addressing yet that larger problem. I think it's great, and we need to fix the problems that we can, but we have an even bigger problem that we're yet to face and address correctly.
What about the assault weapons ban? What about the assault weapons ban proposal, Richard Feldman, and the limit that the president would put on the size of magazines, 10 bullet limit?
We went through this 10, 15, 20 years ago, and more so today than then. You know, we can debate whether it's right or wrong, but from a practical perspective, there are over 100 million high-capacity magazines currently owned by the American people. The impact on stopping the future sale of them on the criminal misuse is really about zero. The same can be said for semi-automatic firearms. As I said to the vice president last week, when we focus on the gun, we miss the opportunity to focus on the problem, which we all agree on, which is in whose hands are the guns.
How about it, Josh? Focus on the gun and you're looking in the wrong direction.
I think that obviously we need a comprehensive approach, and I think that Richard is right that we need to make sure that we're doing all we can in the background check system, and I, of course, applaud him for agreeing with us on that. But I do think that, you know, there may be 100 million magazines out there, but we don't want there to be 200 million magazines out there. And I think the scholars and the academics who have looked at this, and a number of them got together this week at Johns Hopkins, looked at those issues, looked at the research, looked at the evidence, and decided that that was something that was still worth pursuing because it would save lives and reduce the flow of these types of weapons. So we're obviously going to disagree on that, but I do think overall we need to have a multi-pronged approach. And if you think about this as a river, you've got all these different trafficking channels and a number of different issues. There's no one size fits all. We need to look at the problem holistically and see where the guns are flowing from and try to stop that. And I will just back to Richard's point about stolen guns. I was very happy to be at the White House on Friday, the day after Richard was there, and they had a panel on technology, and the technology now to prevent stolen guns is just remarkable, and I'm very pleased to see that there's some support for that in the executive order section of the president's plan.
What do you mean prevent stolen guns? You mean disable them if they are stolen?
Yeah, they'd make them worthless. You could steal it, but the technology would make it either biometrically or through the very sophisticated locks that are very easy to remove, very fast and easy to remove. You can do it by the swipe of your thumb or by a keypad. That would make these guns just pretty much useless to anybody else. So it's very exciting.
Would you support that, Richard Feldman, technology that would disable a stolen gun?
Well, you know, as Josh knows, I'm the guy that negotiated the child safety lock deal with Bill Clinton 15 years ago on behalf of the firearm industry. And I'm always willing and interested in technology when it works. And I agree with Josh. Everything should be on the table. Let's have this open debate. And let's also look to not allow the things we disagree upon to prevent us from moving forward on the vast array of issues that we're all in complete agreement in this country involving the misuse of firearms.
Josh, you know the political currents of the last couple of decades, they've run pretty strong against gun control. Do you think that has really changed? I mean, is Richard Feldman comfortable with this in part because he may feel that, say whatever you want, the votes are going to end up where they've been?
Well, no, actually, I've known Richard for many years, and I think Richard's been comfortable with those positions consistently. Mm-hmm. But so applaud to him on that. But I will say that as far as the current for the rest of the country, you know, the polling on these specific ideas is very high, especially the background check issue. But what's changed, I think, dramatically is the capacity of the gun violence prevention community. So the NRA used to be only the one with the big pack and the grassroots. Well, over the last 5 years since Virginia Tech, we've a lot, because of social media, been able to increase our grassroots by literally millions of people. And so that's been very helpful. The NRA also has a terrible record in elections the last cycle. I mean, people like Tim Kaine from a state like Virginia really took on the NRA and easily won. The president, of course, won. Bill Nelson in Florida, and you can go on and on, where the NRA spent real money in elections. And I think the final part of that is that there are now counterweights to the NRA's influence in the political system, because you have super PACs from Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who actually went after NRA A-rated candidates this cycle and won. And, of course, now you have the emergence of Gabby Gifford's super PAC. So those are things that are going to make voting with us, you know, help push people to vote with us, and also punish people who vote with the NRA. And that's a complete change in the political calculus. And I don't know that, you know, this is going to happen in 2 weeks, but through this season we're coming up with, and through the, certainly as we approach the election, we're going to have, this is a total change, a total game changer as far as the strength of the different parties to this debate.
Charles Babington, the NRA was also pretty influential with Harry Reid and him scraping back to another term in the U.S. Senate. I mean, do you think Harry Reid is even going to bring this up? Take us into the, as far as you can, to the calculus of the Senate Majority Leader. Apparently that's where it's going to have to start, and he apparently is worried about some Democrats in red states who may be in trouble or may have historically felt themselves in trouble if they went down this road. Will he even bring it up?
Well, he's made no signal that he would not bring it up. He has sort of stepped to the background some, and it might be people like Charles Schumer of New York who would be a more forceful voice. Also, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont
who is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, which will be the main committee handling this. And you know, Senator Leahy talks about, you know, that he thinks we need more protections against gun violence, but he also talks about how he's a gun owner and he has a shooting range in the back of his home. So the political reality in the Senate is that in 2014, you've got elections where Democrats are now hold the seats in Alaska, Montana, North Carolina, South Dakota, Louisiana, Arkansas, West Virginia. All of these could be problematic, you know, on the gun issue. Certainly the electorate in those states is going to be quite divided on this, and I think that's one of the concerns that Harry Reid has.
Richard Feldman, I know the NRA is not your outfit, but they've been so out front on all this for so long. To a lot of people, I mean, a lot of people have joined the NRA since Newtown and then the talk of more controls, so duly noted. But a lot have also been put off by the NRA, what can seem like a tin ear in talking about this, that ad that they ran this week on with the president's daughters right in the thick of it, being so fierce on, you know, what we need is more guns to stop the problem of gun violence. Do you think they're reading this right, or could the country be flipping away from them?
Well, you know, the real poll that matters in America is the one that's taken on the first Tuesday after the first Monday of November every 2 years. And the gun issue hasn't been a hot-button issue in American politics really in about 12 or 13 years since the 2000 election cycle. 22 months is a long time to see what people are going to vote on and what happens. So I think it's going to be a very interesting couple of years with this issue. That having been said, our organization, the Independent Firearm Owners Association, does approach the issue a little differently, perhaps. We like to think of ourselves as pro-gun, pro-law enforcement, and pro-intelligence solutions. Those three things are not mutually exclusive.
Josh, do you see a slip in the NRA hold here? Memberships skyrocketed, they say. So how do you read it?
Well, I think the NRA never releases their membership list, so I don't
they
really
assert
know.
That, though.
They assert that. But I want to go back to the thing you said about Harry Reid and the NRA helping him. When it came down to brass tacks, Harry Reid carried a lot of water for the NRA, and then you know what they did? They did not endorse him. They did not endorse him because Sharon Engel was a real staunch Second Amendment remedies type of person. And I bet you Harry Reid remembers that. And I think the other senators from these states are not going to get help from the NRA. When it comes down to it, and it's unfortunate, this has changed. When it comes down to it, the National Rifle Association has become a wing of the Republican Party, and they support Republicans almost exclusively to the exclusion of even pro-gun Democrats. And I think that's going to actually take its toll because people are not going to get help from the NRA. When you look at Baca in California, where when Bloomberg came after him, A-rated NRA candidate, but a Democrat, the NRA didn't step in and try to help. So I think that they have a short memory on these things. I think that hurts the credibility. The other thing is they've clearly come off the rails. I mean, they're so worried about gun owners of America coming to the right of them that they've had to protect their membership, that they've had to go, I believe, completely off the rails with these ads. There's no excuse for that. And if you look at what the president proposed, he's actually proposing more money for, you know, school security guards. So I'm not even sure what the point of the NRA ad is other than to show that they have completely lost touch with reality.
Come back in a year. Are we going to see a difference? People look at the, 200-300 million guns in this country and say, it doesn't matter what you do. We're in an ocean of guns already, period.
Well, look, I think with the executive orders, we've made a difference already. I mean, the ability that we're going to trace all firearms, and then we're going to open up the dealer system now so that people can do, that people who want to do a private party transfer can use a dealer to do the background check. That's something that law-abiding gun owners have wanted for a long time, and it's something that we've wanted for a long time. So I think we're making a difference already. And as Richard says, intelligent solutions, getting data. Right, getting data on solving gun crimes and identifying gun criminals will make a difference. Will you see a dramatic drop in the homicide rate in a year? Probably not. But these things took a long time to develop, and they'll take some time to disperse. But we're definitely already on the right track.
Richard Feldman, you're in Vegas at the gun show, and I hear you say assault rifles, just semi-automatic firearms, flying off the racks there.
Well, the orders are flying off the racks here, but in my walking around the show, I ask everyone, can you actually ship guns? And everyone says, yeah, maybe next September. They're so back-ordered in this industry. If the rest of the American economy was like this, we wouldn't be worried about the deficit.
Richard Feldman with the Independent Firearm Owners Association in Las Vegas. Josh Horowitz with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about gun policy and politics and the president's big push, new push, announced yesterday for change after the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. Charles Babington is with us from the Associated Press, covers Congress in Washington, where a lot of this is headed right now. Robert Spitzer is with us from Cortland, New York, and State University of New York there. He's written a lot about gun control, safety, politics, guns, the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. The president saying yesterday, if there's going to be a change, it's going to take a lot of Americans speaking up about it.
We're going to need voices in those areas, in those congressional districts where the tradition of gun ownership is strong, to speak up and to say this is important. It can't just be the usual suspects. We have to examine ourselves and our hearts and ask ourselves what is important. This will not happen unless the American people demand it.
Charles Babington, Bob Spitzer, let me bring our listeners in. Robbie's calling, Ronnie's calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Ronnie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, has there been a study of the effects on children seeing armed guards in all these schools? Say you take your kindergartner to school and he asks, why are all these people standing around with these guns? What do we say? They're there to protect you from the evil, bad, crazy people? You know, now the school goes from being a supportive, protected place to play and constantly being surrounded by people with guns. Does this vision of guns instill the idea as they grow up that they need guns to feel protected in life from others?
I know what you mean, Ronnie. Robert Spitzer, let me bring that to you. The NRA's big push for armed guards of one kind or another in American schools as the answer. I mean, you can look at that and think, my gosh, are we pushing for some kind of garrison state here? What about Ronnie's concern?
Yeah, Ronnie raises an interesting question. I don't know of any systematic studies that talk about the effects of on students of having an armed guard presence. But it's important to note that the idea of having police officers or what they call resource officers in public schools isn't a new idea. It's really an idea that took off after Columbine in 1999 and then also after 9/11 in 2001. One of the jobs of these officers in schools, my wife taught the public school for many years, and they had a resource officer too in their school in a fairly rural area. And one of the things they try to do is integrate the officer into the life of the school. So the officer is, you know, interacting with students, becoming a friendly face, kind of dealing with routine things. But what's happened over the years is that some of these positions have fallen by the wayside as budget cutting has been a big issue in public schools. And frankly, these resource officers often don't have a lot to do, or what they're dealing with are pretty small bore kinds of routine things that happen in schools. But the notion that you need have an armed guard or an armed officer in every single school in America is really kind of an over-the-top notion, I think, that educators by and large have rejected.
I mean, but are we at the point where you get into, is there a kind of self-fulfilling dynamic here? You get such a gun-soaked country, and there are, you know, those hundreds of millions of guns out there, so gun-soaked that it's all kind of Wild West, must be a gun everywhere or nobody's safe. Is that an inescapable mentality now with all the guns out there, or can we turn that river around, Bob?
Well, it's really a little more complicated than that. There are a great many guns in America. The figure that's often cited is 300 million. But we need to remember several other things. One is that those guns are not uniformly distributed throughout the country. These days, roughly a third of all Americans own one or more guns. Gun ownership has actually been declining in America for about the last 50 years. And even though the total number of guns in America today is greater than it was decades ago, by and large, it's gun owners, people who are existing gun owners, who are acquiring more guns. So the per gun average the gun average per person has actually gone up. So we have a lot of guns, but they're not uniformly distributed. They're more in rural areas, and most of them are traditional hunting, sporting-type weapons. People aren't toting them around society by and large.
Charles Babington, when it comes to votes in Congress, I mean, you point out, don't look to the national mood. Look to it district by district, because that's where this gets decided. How does that math work, Chuck?
Tom, that's exactly right. Just as we've seen on issues like the fiscal cliff and the debt ceiling, you have to remember that of all the political players in this, the only ones elected nationwide are Barack Obama and Joe Biden. And 435 House members are elected from districts, many of which are very liberal or very conservative. And particularly in these very conservative districts, you know, Mitt Romney clobbered Barack Obama, and the members are not as moved, but, you know, we tend to see this as a national issue, a national tragedy in Newtown, which of course it was, but the political reality that these members view their reelections from is district by district. And in many of these districts, it's a clear-cut, a pro-gun sentiment, a low-tax sentiment, that sort of thing. And so it's very difficult for a Speaker Boehner or other national Republican figures to move these members with a sort of national type of argument.
What about even in those districts? I mean, the president nationally did very well with women in the last election. You can't help wondering about moms, even in those very deep red districts, looking at Newtown and thinking, I don't know about this. Maybe this is too far. I mean, is this a kind of wedge issue that may even get to be something difficult for Republicans in those districts, Chuck, or no?
President Obama made a direct appeal to voters in the more conservative district. He said, we need people to speak up, even in areas where, you know, gun control is not very popular. We'll see. It's a difficult it does divide Democrats much more so than issues such as, you know, Social Security, tax policy, that sort of thing. But as Professor Spitzer noted, the facts about gun ownership are changing, and it's possible that this debate will change the laws and the thinking. I do think it's probably an uphill battle.
Austin in Richmond, Kentucky. Austin, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
My question is prior to the Connecticut shooting, where was this urgent executive order from President Obama when the Aurora shootings happened in Colorado?
Well, what are you suggesting? That was before the election, so he didn't want to make it a big deal? You know, what's the suggestion in your question?
I think the way that I'm looking at it is, I'm not saying that President Obama thinks that the lives in Connecticut were any more valuable than the lives that were taken in Colorado.
Yep.
But I just don't understand why now. I don't understand why he waited to do anything about the gun ban until after he was elected and the Colorado shootings took place. Because, I mean, mass shootings have been taking place in the United States and more prevalent in recent years. I just don't understand why now.
Well, I mean, there is something pretty compelling about 5- and 6-year-olds gunned down with a semi-automatic rifle and nobody able to do anything about it. What about just on the face of it, Austin? You know, you must have felt the emotional hit of that. Who wouldn't?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm a father of two, and, you know, it's not that I'm scared to take my kids to school. It's I want that sense of security. But at the same time, I don't think that the lives in Colorado were any less important. I think that preventative measures should have been taken maybe even years ago, maybe even before the Colorado shootings, as opposed to now. And another thing that I do want to say is about the, you know, the two magazines, 7 rounds in each, what was passed in New York. I'm in the Army, and I don't know if anybody has ever been in a firefight that's making these bans, but I do want to say this. When you're in a firefight and the adrenaline's pumping, 7 rounds goes by at a blink of an eye. Now, if I'm in my own home and someone breaks in and they're trying to take the lives of my kids or my wife, 7 rounds isn't going to cut it. And especially if the guy's breaking in as a criminal and he has access to more things than I do. I mean,
isn't the point to try and create a country where we're not in the middle of firefights, where that's not our lives?
Absolutely, and I agree. However, that's inevitable. There's always going to be people out there who are willing to take someone's life to better themselves.
And down we go into those big numbers. Austin, let us pick it up. Chuck, first to you on the president's calculus here. This is not the first massacre on his watch. And you hear that kind of politically loaded question from Austin, why now? Why on this one? This hasn't been a president who pushed hard on guns, and by all implications, that wasn't high on his agenda for this next term either.
You had a quote, Tom, at the top of your show from Vice President Biden saying that Newtown changed everything. And I think that's just the way they're looking at it, is that the facts of the Sandy Hook shooting were so horrendous, so emotional, so gut-wrenching that it moved this issue up to the front burner and of politics and of public opinion. So I think it's no more complicated than that.
And Bob Spitzer, what about this? New York has said 7 rounds max in a magazine, in a clip. The president's saying 10. And you hear Austin, he's worried, he's in the military, but he's worried about being in a firefight in this country, maybe in his own home. And that goes by in the blink of an eye. He says, that's not enough.
Well, it's easy, indeed, if you have a weapon that has a large capacity magazine, there is a certain tendency to fire lots of rounds. We know that police officers fired more rounds when they were given weapons that had larger clips, larger magazines. Mm-hmm. But that isn't necessarily the best way you want to defend your home. The notion that you want to have a 10 or 30 round magazine at the ready to defend your home from a predator, I think, is problematic. I would just add one thing about the electoral mood and the change. There's no doubt that that the shooting in Connecticut changed everything. But it is also true that President Obama consciously wanted to avoid the gun issue during the election cycle, as did his opponent Mitt Romney. And that calculus undoubtedly had an effect on the fact that both candidates avoided that issue pretty much this past summer.
Why do you think America is caught up in such a whirl around guns? Yes, we've got the Second Amendment. It's in our Constitution. But why is this country so obsessed with guns? I mean, look, Australia, they had their problems with terrible massacre there. They changed their policy. They had a conservative prime minister writing to Americans recently saying, we did it and you can do it too. And they went out and they actually bought back semi-automatic weapons, 700,000, the equivalent of 40 million in the U.S. They did that. What is it about this country that makes that seem so difficult to imagine here, Bob?
Well, I think there are a couple things at play. One is that the sheer number of guns in modern America are greater, and that's a pattern that it goes back many decades. Gun ownership was probably relatively rare early in the country's history for a variety of reasons, but it certainly became more common and much more common in recent decades. But there also is a very strong strain of individualism and anti-government sentiment among segments of the population that really encourages them, and this notion that only I can defend myself. I don't trust the government. And that attitude has played a big role for some Americans who want to acquire guns, who want to acquire more guns as a political statement, aside and apart from using guns for hunting or personal reasons. And that ideology, that ethos, also is pumped up by the romanticizing of our past history, where guns certainly played a role, but played far less of a role than most people think. Well, in the 19th century, we had much stronger gun controls in the Wild West than we have in many states today.
Wow. How much of this do you think is pumped up by the gun manufacturers as, business, marketing, drumming up business?
It's essential to what they do. It's core to what they do. They pump up the history. They also pump up fear of the government, and they use both of those things, romanticizing our past, mythologizing the past, combined with anti-government rhetoric, which has been a steady drumbeat of the gun lobby and gun manufacturers, because those are ways you can sell guns and make some money and also push as many guns into society as possible, which is the goal both of the NRA and of the gun industry.
And yet, think about it. Who wants to live in firefight country? Molly in Huntington, Vermont. Molly, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
I've just been listening to a lot of conversations on NPR and elsewhere, and I feel a common thread through all of them is like a complete ignorance of mental illness. And it just seems like everyone's talking about them in the same vein as criminals. And, just because someone's hospitalized for depression or obsessive compulsive disorder does not mean that they're dangerous and that they shouldn't be allowed to own guns. And I just think it's really unfair the way everyone's talking about them.
Let us just pick it up right there. I mean, and Bob, I'll bring it first to you. I mean, there's a lot of talk about, well, how do you know exactly who? And you know, what should disqualify a person, and how significant a problem? But if you don't go at that, then you've got a risk factor. And certainly the gun lobby has said, look there, look at those issues of mental health.
Yeah, the whole realm of mental illness is extremely complex. There are many different kinds of mental illness. It doesn't mean that anybody who has some kind of mental illness diagnosis necessarily ought to be kept away from guns. But by the same token, it's abundantly clear that we have done too little to keep guns out of the hands of categories of mentally ill people who most would agree ought not to have those kinds of guns. And while Molly refers to it as being unfair, it might be unfair, but there is a compelling state interest, a compelling interest in public safety to scrutinize more carefully the link between those who are mentally ill and those who get guns. We know from a recent study that a clear majority of those who have committed mass shootings in recent decades were had demonstrable mental illness problems well known to family and friends, and had any police authority, let's say, made an inquiry before they obtained their guns. 80% of mass shooters have gotten their guns legally in the last several decades. That was a link where much more could have been done, and perhaps more will be done.
Hey, Chuck Babington, you know, there are big waves in politics. There's been a big conservative wave since Ronald Reagan in this country. People talk about maybe that's changing. Demographics and more might change that in the coming decade. I mean, could the era of the gun in America change with that, Chuck?
It's certainly possible, Tom. You know, you see dramatic change, for example, on gay rights, gay marriage. There's just dramatic social change in attitudes on that issue. And some issues don't seem to change very much. You might say we've moved to the left on that issue, but we've certainly moved to the right on many other issues. Taxes are at almost an all-time very low comparatively speaking, but there's a big push to make them lower. So these things are all different. They run on different tracks. Whether Newtown will make a dramatic change in gun opinions, I just don't know.
Well, it certainly has touched a lot of hearts. It's got the country thinking and talking about guns in a way that I do not remember the equal of. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us this hour. Charles Babington, congressional reporter in Washington for the Associated Press. Chuck, you're always great. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Robert Spitzer, author of Gun Control and The Right to Bear Arms from State University of New York at Cortland. Bob, thank you so much for being here.
You bet, Tom.
We will watch this issue. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.